Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, you've brought us a really fascinating subject, Lilith. I mean, she's a figure who's been part of folklore for, well, centuries, constantly shifting and really capturing imaginations.
Yes, absolutely. And the collection of material you've put together on her is incredibly rich. It really spans the gamut, from ancient writings right up to very modern takes. So our goal today, I think, is to really unpack this complex figure.
Yeah, try and understand her journey through history and culture.
Exactly how she's transformed.
Because the first impression you get, it's so varied, isn't it? Like some accounts paint her as this terrifying demon, really dangerous, especially to kids. But then you see these other portrayals where she's like a powerful symbol of female strength,
Yeah.
of independence.
It's quite the contrast.
Totally. So we're going to delve into all those different facets today. Okay, so let's start right at the beginning. Her ancient origins. Where does this story even start?
Well, it's incredibly insightful to look at where Lilith likely came from. And the sources you've shared, they strongly suggest roots deep in Mesopotamian mythology. We see pretty clear connections to figures known as the Lilutu demons.
Lily too.
Yes, and another important figure, Lamashtu, the whole idea, the fear of female demons attacking infants. That's a really deeply rooted archetype. It predates the Lilith we usually think of today.
Okay, Lamashtu. Tell me a bit more about her. Why was she so significant back then?
Lamashtu was, well, originally a Babylonian goddess, actually, but over time she got kind of demonized. One of her main associations was harming infants and new mothers.
Ah, okay. So that's a direct parallel to Lilith later on.
A really striking parallel, yeah, to a key aspect of Lilith's portrayal in Jewish tradition much later. And it's interesting, we even see similar protective measures. People use amulets, incantations, things like that against Lamashtu.
Just like they did for Lilith.
Exactly. The same kinds of things were used later against Lilith.
So was Lilith just like a straightforward continuation of Lamashtu, or is it more complicated?
It's a bit more complicated. That's a crucial distinction, actually. Lamashtu, even though she ended up seen as demonic, she started out as a deity, part of the Mesopotamian pantheon.
Okay.
Lilith, on the other hand, while she clearly draws influence from those earlier figures, you can see the threads she evolved into this singular demon figure within Jewish tradition. And really critically, she gets woven into the story around Adam and Eve.
Ah, right. Lamashtu didn't have that connection.
No, not that specific Adam and Eve link.
That feels like a major turning point, integrating her into the creation narrative itself. Were there other Mesopotamian influences beyond the infant harming aspect?
Oh, absolutely. The characteristics people associated with the Lulu and Lilutu demons, often described as sexual spirits, nocturnal spirits, they likely played a pretty big role in shaping Lilith's later image, the seductive, dangerous creature of the night thing.
Right.
So you could definitely see Lilith as maybe a Hebrew adaptation, kind of a localized version of these broader Mesopotamian demonic figures.
Okay, so from Mesopotamia, the idea or parts of it seems to travel west. What about parallels in Greco-Roman mythology?
Yeah, when you look at the bigger picture of ancient beliefs about these like harmful female spirits, you find really compelling parallels between Lilith and the Greek figure Lamia.
Lamia, okay.
Yeah, both of them share this deeply unsettling motif, right? A woman who, often because of some tragedy or transgression, turns into a monster that preys on children.
It's chilling how that specific theme repeats.
It is. You see this consistent sort of cross-cultural anxiety about powerful, untamed female figures, especially ones linked with the night and vulnerable newborns. It highlights this really primal fear that Lilith would later embody, but within a very specific theological context.
It really makes you wonder about the societal anxieties driving these stories.
Yeah.
And the Romans, they had similar figures too, didn't they?
They did, yeah. The Roman Lamiae, that's the plural, and also the Striges, these screech owl type witches, they were similarly associated with the night, with harming infants. Some stories even said they drank their blood. And here's a really fascinating link. Some early Latin translations of the Bible in the book of Isaiah actually use the word Lamia for Lilith.
Wow, seriously. So a direct linguistic connection right there.
It really is. And it wasn't just like a random translation choice. Medieval scholars, they recognized this connection too. There was Augustine Calmet, an 18th century scholar. His work shows how people understood these links even into the early Enlightenment. He explicitly said the Hebrew Lilith referred to the same beings the Greeks called Strix or Lamia.
These sorceresses believed to kill newborns.
Exactly. That's how he framed it.
So this idea of a female night demon targeting kids really took hold across different cultures. Were there other similarities in, like, how they were described visually?
Yeah, often both figures had this kind of dual nature. They could appear alluring, seductive, but also be utterly horrific. Lamia was often depicted with, like, the upper body of a woman and the lower body of a serpent.
Oh, interesting. Like a snake woman.
Right. And that visual was sometimes applied to Lilith, too, in later art. But again, similar to Lamashtu, the real crucial difference is Lilith getting integrated into that central theological story, you know, Adam's first wife.
Right. The Greco-Roman figures didn't have that specific backstory within a creation myth.
Exactly.
That backstory being Adam's first wife.
Mm.
That seems to be the element that really makes Lilith unique. Where does that specific story actually come from?
Yeah, it's quite telling that this idea, Adam having a wife before Eve, it's largely unique to Jewish folklore. The main source for this story is a medieval text called the Alphabet of Ben Sira.
Okay, so this isn't in Genesis or the main biblical texts.
No, definitely not canonical scripture. It's folklore, midrashic literature.
So what does it say? Why was Lilith supposedly replaced by Eve in that version?
Well, according to this tradition, Lilith was created at the same time as Adam, and crucially, from the same earth, same source material.
Okay, equals from the start.
Right. But she refused to submit to him, specifically in sexual positions. She argued for equality. The text actually quotes her saying something like, "Why should I lie beneath you? I am your equal, since we were both created from dust."
Wow.
Because of that defiance, she left Adam. Depending on the version you read, she either flew off to the Red Sea and consorted with demons, or maybe just fled. God then supposedly sent angels to try and bring her back.
And she refused.
She refused, point blank, and apparently stated her purpose was now to harm newborns and mothers, which, you know, loops back to those earlier demon figures.
Yeah.
But that refusal to submit, that's the core of it. And it's been powerfully flipped in modern times, hasn't it? From a demonic trait to a symbol of, like, ultimate female autonomy.
It's a hugely different origin story compared to Eve being made from Adam's rib.
Mm.
And you mentioned parallels in Islamic lore as well.
Yes. It seems early Islamic traditions, probably influenced by, you know, local folklore and maybe Jewish stories circulating at the time, talk about a demoness called Karina. Sometimes she's called Mother of Children.
Karina.
Right. And some accounts depict her as Adam's first mate, who was also rejected. In that version, she then allies herself with the devil, Iblis, becomes the mother of demons, and attacks human infants, basically as revenge.
The parallels are really striking again.
Yeah.
Rejection, demonic kids attacking babies.
Absolutely. And in some later Arab folklore, you actually see a kind of merging of Lilith and Karina, which suggests, you know, cross-cultural exchange, a blending of these figures. It really shows how certain archetypes can pop up and adapt in different religious settings.
It's interesting, like you said, how rare this specific rejected first wife idea is outside Abrahamic traditions.
Exactly. Most cultures have an Eve figure, right? The first woman, mother of humanity, but not necessarily a Lilith figure, this primal woman who actively refuses to submit and then gets demonized for it. You have figures like Pandora in Greek myth, or maybe Angerboda in Norse myth.
Mm.
They bring trouble or have monstrous kids.
But they aren't usually the first woman rejected for disobedience.
Precisely. It's not quite the same narrative structure. This unique combination in Lilith, the mixing of the first woman role with the demon role, that's really what sets her apart, I think.
So moving on from those ancient and early medieval roots, how did Lilith fit into the more, let's say, structured demonology of the later Middle Ages and the Renaissance? Did she become more prominent?
Yeah, as Christian demonology became more systematized, Lilith got increasingly linked with succubi. You know, those female demons believed to seduce men in their sleep. She was often named as their queen, or sometimes even their mother. And this concept of her demonic offspring, the Lilin, became pretty common. They were basically seen as more succubi, following in their mother's footsteps, tempting men, fathering demon babies.
So she's climbing the ladder in the demonic hierarchy.
Pretty much. By the Renaissance, you find her holding a pretty high rank in various occult texts. Things like the Alphabet of Solomon and numerous magical grimoires.
The spell books.
Yeah, books of magic spells, rituals that were popular then. These texts often had, you know, instructions, incantations, supposedly for interacting with or even commanding demons like Lilith.
And what about the vampire connection you mentioned earlier? That sounds like maybe a later development.
Yes, the overlap between Lilith and vampire legends seems to have grown over time. I mean, given her nocturnal nature, her association with harming the vulnerable, especially infants, it wasn't a huge leap for some to see her as a kind of nocturnal blood drinker.
Makes sense.
Scholars like Augustine Calmet, again, the 18th century guy, he noted the similarities between stories about Lilith and tales of vampires and witches who were thought to drain blood. And this connection has really taken root in modern fiction. Lilith is very frequently portrayed as the first vampire.
The original vampire.
Yeah, the progenitor of the whole undead line in some stories. But what's key, I think, is that her foundation in religious lore gives her a different kind of weight. You know, she's not just a generic folkloric vampire.
Right. She has that deeper theological backstory humming underneath. Okay, so jumping ahead a few centuries, we see this big romantic and Victorian revival of interest in Lilith. What kicked that off?
Well, the 19th century saw this really significant resurgence of interest in Lilith, particularly in the arts. One of the earliest and probably most influential appearances was in Goethe's Faust.
Faust.
Yeah, published way back in 1808, in the famous Walpurgis Night scene, Faust encounters Lilith, and Mephistopheles gives him this very specific warning about her. He says something like, "She excels all women in the magic of her locks. When she winds her hair around young men, she won't let them go."
Her hair. That's such a potent image of her seductive power.
It really is. And that theme, the dangerous allure, was picked up enthusiastically by Romantic and Victorian writers and artists. You mentioned the Pre-Raphaelite painter-poet Dante Gabriel Rossetti.
His painting Lady Lilith.
Exactly, from the 1860s. It shows her as this, like, languid, mesmerizing femme fatale staring into a mirror, all that flowing hair. And he wrote a sonnet to go with it, reinforcing that image. The enchantress subtly drawing men in.
So the focus really shifted, didn't it? From the child-killing demon to this, like, alluring but dangerous woman.
Precisely. That became the dominant image. Other literary works follow, too. Like, Robert Browning wrote a poem called Adam, Lilith, and Eve, imagining a conversation between them. And George MacDonald wrote a whole fantasy novel called Lilith.
Oh, yeah. How did he portray her?
It's complex. His version involves sin, redemption. She even has vampiric traits in his story, and a fear of children, which kind of echoes those older legends. So across all these different works, Lilith was increasingly seen less as just a demon and more as this richly symbolic character, representing the power and maybe the peril of female sexuality.
The quintessential femme fatale.
By the end of the 19th century, yeah, she'd pretty much cemented that role in art and literature.
Okay, so that sets the stage perfectly for the next really big transformation. The feminist reinterpretation of Lilith in the 20th and 21st centuries. This feels like a massive shift.
It really is. Instead of just accepting the traditional demonization, feminist thinkers, writers, artists, they began to powerfully reimagine Lilith, to see her as a symbol of female independence, of resistance against, you know, patriarchal structures.
And the logic is right there in her origin story, isn't it?
Exactly. As your sources point out, it's inherent in that Alphabet of Bensira story. She was the woman who refused to submit to Adam's authority, who chose to leave paradise rather than be dominated.
So her defiance flips from being evil to being an act of self-determination, a strength.
Exactly. That aspect of her legend has been actively reclaimed, especially in modern feminist midrash, you know, re-examining ancient texts through a feminist lens and in literature. Judith Plaska's story from 1972, The Coming of Lilith, is a really key example.
That is that would reframe it.
It reframes Lilith and Eve not as rivals, but as potential allies. Both women who suffered under a patriarchal system, just in different ways. It's a very powerful rewriting.
And then there's the magazine, Lilith Magazine. That's a very deliberate, explicit embrace of her symbolism.
Oh, absolutely. Founded in 1976, a Jewish feminist publication, they specifically named it after Lilith to honor her as, and I think this is their phrasing, the quintessential female rebel, a woman who would not take orders from a man. Their explanation makes it really clear. Her rebellion, even in sexuality, made her a figure worth emulating in the eyes of modern feminism.
So she goes from being demonized for her independence to being celebrated for it.
Pretty much, yeah. And feminist spirituality movements have also really embraced Lilith, seeing her as an archetype of the fierce divine feminine, a powerful counterpoint to more maybe traditionally passive female figures in religion.
No, it's not all positive. Right?
There are.
The sources mention some lingering concerns.
Right. It's important to acknowledge that not all modern interpretations are entirely positive or celebratory. That association with harming infants it still raises concerns for some people, understandably.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd say the dominant trend, certainly within feminist circles, has been to rehabilitate Lilith. To argue that her demonic portrayal was basically the result of patriarchal societies trying to suppress a strong, independent woman.
So in that context, she becomes this potent cultural symbol.
Yeah, of women's autonomy, their sexuality, their refusal to be dominated. It's quite a turnaround.
It's truly remarkable how a figure condemned for so long can undergo such a complete reevaluation. And this reimagining, it's clearly spilled over to popular culture, too. I mean, you see Lilith popping up everywhere in modern media.
Oh, definitely. Her presence in modern pop culture is, well, it's widespread. Across genres, horror, fantasy, even music, as we'll see. In books and comics, she often shows up as a powerful demoness or maybe a sorceress, usually keeping that alluring but dangerous edge.
The C.S. Lewis reference you found in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. That's interesting. Making the White Witch a descendant of Lilith gives her this feeling of ancient, almost primordial evil.
It does, doesn't it? And then you look at modern horror and urban fantasy. TV shows, video games, graphic novels. Lilith is a recurring character. Shows like Supernatural had a version of her, True Blood did, usually as a pretty formidable demon.
And she's big in role-playing games, too.
Yeah, her significance in RPG lore is quite notable. The vampire. The Masquerade franchise, for example, often puts her right at the center of vampire mythology. Sometimes, like we discussed, as the original vampire, often positioned as a counterpoint to the biblical Adam.
Right, and we can't forget the Lilith Fair music tour from the 90s. That's a pretty mainstream cultural touchstone.
Exactly. Another clear example of her name and the symbolism associated with her resonating in contemporary culture. In that case, celebrating female musicians, which ties back to the feminist reinterpretation.
So what's consistent across these pop culture versions?
Well, most of them tend to retain elements of her original myth, right? Immortality, seductiveness, a dangerous nature, but often updated with a modern twist. Sometimes she's an anti-heroine, or maybe a more complex villain than just pure evil.
Her staying power is undeniable.
Totally. Her continued appearance in so many different forms just shows the lasting intrigue of her character. She's probably one of the most globally recognized figures to come out of Jewish folklore, often just shorthand for a seductive dark woman or a vengeful female demon.
It seems like alongside pop culture, in some spiritual circles, particularly occult and neo-pagan movements, Lilith has gone through yet another major transformation, almost being elevated to a goddess.
You're absolutely right. Within contemporary occultism, neopaganism, Lilith has experienced what you could almost call an apotheosis, basically being raised to divine status. Many people within modern witchcraft and pagan communities now approach her not just as a demon from folklore, but as a goddess, or maybe a dark divine figure.
So goddess Lilith is a term people actually use.
Oh, yes. Neo-pagan literature frequently refers to goddess Lilith, celebrating her as an embodiment of the powerful, the untamed feminine principle.
It feels like she's come full circle in a way, from
yeah.
maybe a proto-deity in ancient Mesopotamia to a demon in Abrahamic faiths, and now back to a goddess figure for some modern groups.
It's fascinating, isn't it? And in these modern spiritual circles, she often holds this kind of dual status, both deity and demon, depending on the context or tradition. She might be invoked as a protector of women or a patron of witches, maybe a symbol of sexual liberation.
How do occult writers describe her?
Often as a dark goddess, someone you can work with in magic, but who commands respect. They acknowledge both her beauty and her, well, fearsome aspects. Some Wiccan and pagan traditions have incorporated her into their pantheons, seeing her as representing the shadow side of womanhood, the mysteries of the night.
And what about in, say, more overtly satanic or left-hand path traditions? Do they recognize her?
They do. Anton LaVey's Satanic Bible, for instance, lists Lilith among the infernal names, specifically calls her the Princess of Hell and Mother of Succubi, which clearly connects back to some of those older demonological ideas, just within a different framework.
So a really wide range of interpretations, even within modern spirituality.
Exactly. Across these movements, she's been transformed into this potent icon of power. Whether she's revered as a deity or maybe channeled as a powerful demoness, it's a significant departure from her purely fearsome portrayal in ancient texts. As one occult source you shared puts it quite well, in neo-paganism and modern occultism, Lilith is typically regarded as either a deity, goddess Lilith, or a demon, a succubus. It highlights that dichotomy.
It's amazing how these contrasting views can coexist. Really shows how fluid and adaptable myths and figures can be. Okay, so looking back at everything we've covered, all these different portrayals, what are the key comparisons we can draw between Lilith and other figures across cultures?
Well, as we've kind of traced, Lilith definitely aligns with, but also significantly diverges from, other mythological figures. She certainly embodies those shared motifs, right? The dangerous night female demon, you see that archetype everywhere. Lamashtu in Mesopotamia, Lamia in the Strix in Greece and Rome, the succubi in Christian demonology.
That pattern is clear.
Yeah, the seductive, potentially child-threatening female night spirit is a recurring pattern. But it's her unique narrative arc within Jewish tradition that really sets her apart. She isn't just some nameless monster lurking in the dark.
She's part of the creation story.
Exactly. She's a rebellious woman who was part of the creation story, Adam's first wife. This fusion of a creation myth with demonology, it's pretty unusual, and it's given her this depth and complexity that many other similar figures just don't quite have.
So that combination is key to her lasting appeal.
I think so, yeah. At the end of the day, her enduring fascination seems to come from that powerful mix. She taps into a universal archetype, the dangerous night hag, but she also plays this very specific, very provocative role as the defiant first woman.
So from an ancient Mesopotamian demon to a medieval queen of succubi, then a Victorian femme fatale, evolving into a modern feminist icon, and even achieving a kind of goddess status in some contemporary beliefs. Lilith's journey has been, well, truly extraordinary.
It really has. She's been both feared, you know, as this sinister force of the night, and celebrated as a powerful symbol of feminine strength and independence. It's quite the spectrum.
And within Jewish folklore specifically, she seems to embody so many cultural anxieties, doesn't she? About sex, female autonomy, child rearing.
Absolutely. All condensed into one unforgettable, legendary figure. She's like this fascinating focal point for all those complex issues.
And her story just keeps getting reinterpreted. Each new version seems to reflect the values, the concerns of the society that's engaging with her myth at that time.
Precisely. Whether she's seen as a demon you need to ward off or a heroine you should admire, Lilith remains one of the most enigmatic and, frankly, resilient figures in mythology.
So maybe a final thought for you, the listener, to chew on. How does this enduring, constantly evolving story of Lilith reflect our own, often shifting understanding of things like power, rebellion, and maybe even the feminine divine? And looking ahead, what new and unexpected forms might her legend take in the centuries to come?
It makes you wonder.
It really does. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.